We pray that we would understand more about the origin and nature of the world and about you, its creator. And as we do so, please enable us to respond appropriately. Amen. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Statements don't come much more foundational than that. We're going through the Bible over the next year, looking at all, I hope, of its main themes. And time and again, we will come back to that basic fact. Passage after passage, you will find either assumes that God is the creator or implies that he is the creator. It's absolutely fundamental. God created the heavens and earth out of nothing. And then he ordered them. It says here, he divided the light from the darkness, the sea from the land, from the air. He ordered the days, the seasons, the years. And then he filled the earth with plants and animals and ultimately man. Keep all of that in mind, and an awful lot else becomes clear. The tragedy is that over recent times, Christians have been almost defensive about this idea of God as creator. I think some Christians believe that God is creator as a matter of faith, and yet secretly fear that the humanists have the rather better of the arguments. And I know there's just been a Theos survey suggesting that 60% of the people of this country believe in creation. Clearly I don't meet them, because my experience is that an awful lot of people who are not Christians or Muslims or one of the great monotheistic religions, they don't think about God as creator at all. Why is that? Well, in a word, science. Or to be more specific, the Big Bang and creation. An awful lot of people fear that if they're Christians, or think it's done away with the need for a creator God if they're not. And that really is most frustrating, because philosophically, Christians have the better of the arguments, and there's no necessary conflict between Christianity and science. And because of that, what I'm going to do in this sermon is first of all to look at the philosophy, second to look at the science, and then to come back to this in Genesis chapter 1. So I wanted you to do something slightly unusual to start with, and that is pretend that you've never heard of the Bible. In fact, pretend you haven't heard of Christianity at all. And ask yourself a question. What is the fundamental explanation of the universe? What is the final explanation of why things are as they are? Just think about it for a moment. Well, we can dismiss evolution straight away, because evolution explains how things change. If it's right, what it says is that humans came from monkeys, came from mammals, came from amphibians, came from fish. Yeah, okay. But how did it all begin? Any final explanation of the universe has to be eternal. It has to be outside time. Otherwise, by definition, there's an anterior explanation. Now, that's not contentious. That's just simple matter of logic. So what about the Big Bang? Well, the Big Bang has the advantage that if it happened, then time began with the Big Bang. So at least it's eternal. That's progress. But just ask yourself for a moment, what caused the Big Bang? And why did the Big Bang result in the world as we know it, ultimately? That's what philosophers know as the problem of contingency. Any final explanation of the universe has to be eternal, but it also has to explain why things are necessarily as they are and could not be otherwise. And the Big Bang just doesn't do that. Again, that's not a contentious statement. That is a simple matter of philosophy, and that's why philosophers and scientists continue to look for a deeper explanation. Some of you may well have read Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time. It was in the bestsellers list for a while. I think it was the bestseller. Whether it was the best read book, I have no idea. It's pretty heavy going. But those of you who read it and understood it may remember the final chapter in which Stephen Hawking talks about the search for a unified theory of everything in the universe. What he means is a set of mathematical equations which are self-evidently true, or at least prove themselves, and which result in an explanation of why the Earth as it is and could not be otherwise. That's right. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for something which is necessarily true. The problem is we haven't got it. There are no such set of mathematical equations, is no such set of mathematical equations. The search for a unified theory of everything is like the Holy Grail of science. And like the search for the Holy Grail, it leads down increasingly bizarre avenues. In fact, I think most scientists today would say we're not going to find such a unified theory within the confines of our own universe. And as a result, people are beginning to postulate the existence of a series of parallel universes. I have a feeling I know some people who populate them, come to think of it, but that's another story. This is serious, actually. Their postulate is there could be billions of other universes. So we don't have a universe, we have a multiverse. Now, that is not a bizarre, wacky theory. This is mainstream thinking. The Astronomer Royal, Martin Rees, believes that we have a multiverse. Why? Well, because unless you have a multiverse, you can't answer this question of the fundamental nature of reality. The problem is, the multiverse theory doesn't work unless you assume that all possible universes exist, because only then will you have satisfied the requirement of necessity. The difficulty of that is that we can't even define the set of all possible universes. And if you think about what they're like, you get into the bizarre. The theory is of incredible complexity, which goes against most normal philosophical axioms. But it's a bigger problem. There isn't a shred of evidence that it exists. And I'd suggest that believing that requires quite a large dose of faith. So the question is there another explanation that will help us? Now, keep those Bibles away. Don't think about Christianity. Let's just hypothesize something for a moment. Let us hypothesize that there is a supreme intelligence in the universe, which we'll call God. A supreme intelligence existing outside time that willed the creation of the universe. Now, clearly that satisfies the requirement of eternity. We've just defined it as such. But I hear some of you thinking, just a minute, isn't there still a problem? Why did God create the universe? Isn't there still a contingency problem there? What caused God to create the universe? Now, if you're thinking like that, I'm afraid you've just fallen into a materialist determinist trap. Because, some people clearly think that would be fun, because you've assumed that free will doesn't exist. You've assumed that when someone wills something, it is caused by something else in the material world. But you don't think that when you think. So why should it be true of God? If we assume that God has free will, that God has free will because he is God, and the answer to the question, why did he will the creation of the world, is because he is God, there's no problem of contingency. Furthermore, be careful, God exists outside time. There was no time when God did not will the creation of the universe. God willed it all the time. He is outside time. There was never a point when he didn't will it. Now the point is this. We haven't yet referred to the Bible, but we've just satisfied our two fundamental tenets of philosophy, the need for eternity and necessity. I have not proved the existence of God. But what I have done is to demonstrate that unless you demand a materialist explanation, and by the way, that's simply assuming what you're trying to prove, unless you demand that, the hypothesis of a creator God is at least as philosophically justifiable as any materialist alternative. In fact, by the way, there is a good argument, a good logical argument for saying that the multiverse logically implies the existence of God. Talk to me afterwards about it if you want to know the reasoning for that. But leave that aside. Here's the point. I would suggest that belief in the hypothesis of a creator God requires rather less faith than belief in any materialist alternative hypothesis. And what Genesis says is that isn't just a hypothesis, that that creator God does indeed exist. That's the philosophy. Christians do not need to fear philosophy. What about science? What's the problem with science? It's simply this, that modern science appears to suggest that the Earth is billions of years old and developed into what we see today over time. Well, that's fine, so what's the problem with that? Well, the problem is that a lot of people, a lot of Christians, worry about it, and they do so for various reasons. First of all, there are some who believe that somehow creation over a long period of time somehow deprives God of his majesty, and that the creation almost instantly of a mature earth is more supernatural and more godlike than the alternative. But that can't be right. Actually, the Bible shows us God doing things instantly. It shows him doing things over long periods. It shows him doing things over any period. And the distinction between the natural and the supernatural is condemned in Genesis chapter 1 because everything is supernatural. That's what Genesis chapter 1 says. Anything derives from God. No, that's not the problem. The real problem is the question whether the modern science is consistent with what it says here in Genesis chapter 1. That's the real problem. Now, obviously, one possibility is Genesis 1 is wrong. If that were the case, then we would have a serious problem as Christians, because if the Bible's wrong on that, that matter of that fundamental nature, then there really is a problem. But assuming that's not the case, we've got two possible explanations. Either one, the modern science is wrong, or two, the understanding of creation in 6 days and a young earth is wrong. Logically, there's no other possibility. Unfortunately, I'm not a scientist, and I'm certainly not competent to talk about science here this morning, and so I'm going to confine myself to just a couple of comments. First of all, there are eminent, reputable scientists who believe that the currently prevailing scientific theories are wrong. They believe that the evidence for a very ancient Earth is ill-founded. And it is true that the theories which give rise to that explanation of the Earth are based on some pretty gigantic assumptions which you cannot prove. And furthermore, there are problems with the evidence and problems with the theory which do give rise to difficulties, particularly in relation to macroevolution. It's by no means all well buttoned down. But having said that, I think it's also fair to say that those difficulties don't generally go to the question of the fundamental age of the Earth, or indeed to the question of development over time. And personally, I find it quite striking that the evidence of astrophysics, of geology, and of biology all point in the same direction. So speaking personally, I would not be minded to bet against the modern science. Of course, those who believe in a young Earth would say, but Richard, you don't need to bet, because the Bible tells you all you need to know. It says it here. The earth was created in 6 days, and if you look at Genesis chapters 1 to 11, it's about 6,000 years old. You don't need to bet against it, it's clear. And consequently, belief in the modern science is just a denial of the Bible. There's a writer writing a few years ago who said, it is possible to be a Christian evolutionist in the same sense as it's possible to be a Christian adulterer or thief. So no doubt what he thought then. But is it that clear? Now, the Bible is very clear about a number of things. Over the next year, we are going to read about a number of things which are crystal clear. And we should not be ashamed to assert them, no matter what the opposition. But we have to be careful. We have to be careful that we don't attribute infallibility not merely to the Bible, but to our own interpretations of the Bible. We need to be careful. And I would suggest that this passage here in Genesis chapter 1 is in fact more than capable of an explanation entirely consistent with the modern science. I haven't got time to go into all the details of that now, but just a couple of things by way of example. Let's think for a moment about the concept of days and also the sequence of events in this passage. This passage that we've heard read is not poetry in any normal sense, but it's not normal prose either. It has a lot of stylized aspects which suggest that it's not normal prose. Consider all the repeated words. I deliberately ask that the whole passage be read so that you got the sort of the rhythm of the whole thing. There's a lot of repeated words, repeated phrases. There are patterns in it. In the Hebrew, the first verse about the original act of creation is 7 words. The second verse is 14. The final bit about God resting is 35. There are 21 references to the earth, 35 references to God. And for those of you who don't know your 7 times table, those are all multiples of 7. But there's an even bigger stylistic feature. If you look at verse 2, it says, the earth was formless and empty. And the first 3 days of creation talk about the giving of form. They talk about the separation of light from darkness, sea from land, etc. The second 3 days talk about the creation of elements of the universe. The lights, the sun and the moon, the creatures, etc. And the interesting thing is there's a parallelism between them. Light is divided from darkness on day 1. On day 4, the sun and the moon are created. Now, I suspect even someone in the ancient world would have been able to spot that it is the sun that gives light, etc. And what about day 7? There's something odd there. It says that God rested on day 7. Well, we're surely not to understand that literally. God's just created time. He says that right at the beginning. He exists outside time. So the idea that he rested on a human day is very unlikely to be literal. So what I'm suggesting is that this passage should be understood as a semi-poetic, stylized description of the absolutely fundamental truths of creation, but not as a literal scientific account of creation. And just in case some of you are worried that that's a theory invented in modern times to explain the science, it's not. Actually, the best-known theologian of the 2nd century, Origen, held that view. It's about the only part of his theology I find myself agreeing with, but he did. And the great Augustine, at the end of the 4th century, in his commentary on this chapter, took that view. Now, of course, Origen and Augustine, and indeed I, can be wrong. We may well be wrong, but let's remember two things. First of all, if God is creator, there is no need to fear science. All that science will do is to demonstrate more and more the glories of God's creation. And I would suggest that that is exactly what has happened over the last few hundred years. Think how much more we can marvel at God's creation, knowing what we do about atoms and geology and astrophysics and biology. Think how much more we can marvel at that than our predecessors 400 or 500 years ago. Second, we must be very careful that we don't spend our time arguing over minutiae and thereby miss the huge fundamental truths of this passage that will change our lives. We mustn't lose the wood for the trees. So, let's finally move on and have a look at those fundamental truths. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to expound them all. What I'm going to do is just draw attention to half a dozen fundamental truths and invite you, as you read the passages over the coming week, and I very much hope you all will, and as we study this, the Bible, over the coming year, I'd ask you to remember those fundamental truths, because they're like foundations on which the rest of the Bible is built. First of all, three truths about God and the nature of reality. First, going back almost to what we were talking about a moment ago, the fundamental nature of reality is God, not matter. God, the supreme, ever-existing consciousness, not matter. Everything else has its origin in God's created act. There's absolutely no room for polytheism, for different gods. Did you notice when it talks here about the creation of the sun and the moon, it simply says, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night. In ancient religion, the sun and the moon were often considered to be gods. No, says Genesis, they're not gods. They're simply things created by God and serving God's purposes. They are God's lights. There's only one God, and he is supreme. Furthermore, second point, the fundamental nature of reality is not a battle between good and evil. Dualism. Again, in ancient religion, very often the origin of the earth was seen as being God subduing the chaos, the primeval forces of chaos. You might have heard that God created the great creatures of the sea. The word there used is exactly the same as was used by the Canaanites to refer to the great creatures of the sea monsters, who they viewed as being the remnants of those evil forces of chaos. No, says Genesis, they're not. They're just God's creatures. I'm sure we don't share the Canaanites' view of sea creatures. But there is a danger that Christians slip into seeing reality as a battle between good and evil. Now, there is a battle between good and evil, but it's not the fundamental reality of the world. God created everything. The fundamental reality is a good God. Everything else is subordinate. Third point, how did God create? God said, let there be light. God said, let there be an expanse, etc. God created by an act of will. Of course, the word said there isn't literal. We shouldn't imagine that we could have heard God speaking if we had been there. No. God spoke and it was done. This is here in the very first chapter of the Bible, the first example of the teaching that we will hear time and again. God's word is powerful. When God wills something, nothing and nobody can stand in the way. God speaks and things happen. So three things about God. Three things about the universe. First of all, the created order is completely separate from God. Now, there are a lot of people, always have been, in ancient times there were, and there are today, people who believe that either everything is a manifestation of God, pantheism, or that God is in some way in everything, panentheism. No, says Genesis, God is completely separate from the creation which owes its being to God. But then, second point, that does not mean that creation is evil or bad or wrong. Now, Christians down the ages have fallen into this trap time and again, and it's the trap of viewing matter as evil, spirit as good. And there are two things that are fundamentally wrong with that. First of all, don't forget, spiritual things are just as much part of the created order as material things. We don't believe that spirit is original, matter was created. The only original thing is God. Everything else is created. But more than that, seven times, again, yes, seven, it says here, it was good. It was very good, is the final conclusion on the created order. Matter is not evil. Never has been. Third point. Matter may be discrete from God. It may be good. But it is not independent of God. The created order is not independent of God. Indeed, it is completely dependent on God. Dependent on, and in a real sense, owned by God. Did you hear in the passage, several times it says, God called things. God called the expanse sky. The gathered waters he called seas. I think the significance of that is it's an act of ownership by God. It's symbolizing God's ownership of things. If you name something, you're expressing your control over it. That point that the whole universe, including us, is dependent on and owned by God is something that the Bible returns to time and again. So three things about God, three things about matter. One final thing. God created the universe, and if you listened as we were reading through, you'll realize he gave a purpose to all of those things that he was creating. Sun and the moon, lights. The seed-bearing creatures, food, etc. Sorry, seed-bearing plants, food, etc. God created the universe with a purpose, and it has a purpose. We are part of that creation, and we have a purpose. But that's next week's sermon. And we're going to have to wait until next week to think about that further. In the meantime, I'd suggest we just reflect on these fundamental truths. And I'd suggest there's only one reaction we can have, which was expressed in one of our earlier songs, and that is a reaction of awe and worship. A few weeks ago, we heard in Revelation the praise in heaven of God. You are worthy, O Lord and God, to receive glory and honour and praise. For you created all things, and by your will they were created and have their being. It's Genesis, Revelation chapter 4. That is the message of Genesis. That's what we have to think about. Let's worship God.
Thank you very much, Richard. And if you are